From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The U.S.-China face-off over losing face. We'll speak to a former U.S. Air Force captain who flew spy missions over Russia and an editor at Jane's Defense. We'll also take a look at the crisis from the perspective of Chinese history. Then, a physician and scientist talk about why the Bush administration's lowering of arsenic standards is a death sentence for some people who drink America's water. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Striking a slightly stiffer tone, the Bush administration warned China that its relationship with the United States is being hurt and that it risks further harm with every day that the crew of the American spy plane remains in detention. Senior American officials went out of their way to reject the kind of apology China has demanded for the collision between the American plane and a Chinese fighter jet. But Secretary of State Colin Powell used a slightly different formulation to the regret expressed last week. He also said for the first time that the United States is sorry about the loss of the Chinese pilot, and President Bush sent a letter to the pilot's wife. We'll have more on that story in a few minutes. Recovery teams removed the bodies yesterday from the crash of the helicopter searching for remains of American soldiers missing from the Vietnam War. The helicopter crashed into a mountainside in central Vietnam on Saturday, killing all 7 Americans and 9 Vietnamese aboard. The Russian-made Mi-17 helicopter with its Vietnamese pilot was part of a major cooperative search operation throughout Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and southern China that has been underway since 1985 for missing American servicemen. The search for the Americans, about 2,000 of whom are still missing, has been the cornerstone of Vietnam-American relations, an arena of cooperation embraced by both sides as they grope toward a more open political and economic relationship. Scott Evertz, a leader among gay Republicans in Wisconsin, will be named director of the White House Office of National AIDS Policy, according to senior White House officials. Members of gay groups said it was the first time an openly gay man or a lesbian had been chosen for appointment by any Republican administration. But the White House officials, even as they disclosed a step that seemed intended to appeal to gay voters, refused to discuss Evertz's sexuality or its significance in either politics or policy, saying Bush did not take such concerns into account when making appointments. Evertz is an AIDS policy organizer who's head of the Wisconsin Log Cabin Republicans and has ties to Tommy Thompson, the former Wisconsin governor who's now Secretary of Health and Human Services. He'll take over the office as its role expands to coordinate all domestic and international HIV/AIDS policy. A Texas jury awarded $56.6 million to a woman who used diet pills once marketed by American Home Products, the largest single plaintiff award arising from the Fen-Phen diet pill debacle. 2 years ago, American Home Products agreed to pay as much as $3.75 billion to people who took the drugs, which have been linked to heart valve damage. Thousands of people turned down the company's offer, opting to pursue individual lawsuits in court. In the latest Texas case, the plaintiff, Gloria Lopez, took the popular Fen-Phen cocktail for 4 months before it was pulled from the market at the urging of federal regulators in September of 97. American Home Products made Pondamin, a version of fenfluramine, the fen in the combination. Lopez, a public school cafeteria worker, subsequently developed shortness of breath and fatigue and later was diagnosed with a leaky aortic valve. Mideast violence continues even as Yasser Arafat sent Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon Passover greetings. Palestinians claimed Israel used surface-to-surface rockets in a Gaza Strip bombardment, while Palestinian gunmen killed a suspected collaborator and Israeli Special Forces soldiers seized 2 Palestinian militia leaders. Peru's Alejandro Toledo finished first in presidential elections but fell short of avoiding a second round in late May or early June. Alan Garcia led Lourdes Flores in the race for the runoff second spot. Thousands of Russians marched to show support for NTV workers trying to block a takeover of the independent station by the state-run gas company. Ted Turner has urged journalists to continue working there while he negotiates to buy a stake. And Iran arrested 42 more members of what was the only legal opposition group until it was banned last month. A hardline clerical court ordered the arrests as it attempts to derail a reelection bid by President Khatami. And finally, Europe's cattle woes soon could raise the price Americans pay for leather bomber jackets, sneakers, and high-end handbags. Mad cow and foot-and-mouth diseases, two unrelated plagues on European cattle, have dented the international supply of cow hides used to make leather goods. Europe is a major supplier of hides, contributing nearly 17% of the global supply of hides and skins in 1998. Paul Robeson singing No More Auction Block. He would have been 103 years old today. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. China's powerful military establishment weighed in on the crisis over the 24 detained U.S. air crew yesterday by vowing that the United States would not be allowed to escape responsibility for the spy plane incident. But as the crew of the surveillance aircraft began a second week in custody on Hainan Island, China demanded a full apology for last Sunday's crash off its south coast. China's main military newspaper, the Liberation Army Daily, quoted Defense Minister Chi Haoqian saying the collision was entirely caused by the U.S. side. The newspaper demanded the United States halt surveillance flights off China's coast. On the American side, Vice President Dick Cheney insisted that Washington had no intention of apologizing for their mid-air collision, which downed a Chinese fighter, killed the Chinese pilot. And Secretary of State Colin Powell insisted that the U.S. plane did nothing wrong and that the U.S. bore no responsibility for the crash. But in the background are deep tensions between the two countries. The Chinese military brass is still smarting over the U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999. And the People's Liberation Army is alarmed by the prospect of U.S. sales of high-technology weapons to Taiwan and plans for a missile defense shield that would emasculate China's small nuclear arsenal. We're going to start off by talking to Martin Streetley, who is editor of Jane's Electronic Mission Aircraft, about the U.S. plane and just how sophisticated it is and what kind of catch it is for the Chinese government. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
We speak to Martin Streetley in London, England. What kind of plane is this?
In the jargon, the EP3 Ares 2 is what is known as a signals intelligence aircraft. And in this instance, it has two capabilities, what are known as electronic intelligence, that is primarily the ability to listen to, record, and analyze radar signals, and what is known as communications intelligence, that is the ability to listen into and record military radio networks. So in this instance, we know that there was at least one Chinese linguist on board, So they would have been able to listen to Chinese military communications.
And is it true that the U.S. airmen on board destroyed some of the plane as it was going down?
It's my understanding that the U.S. Navy has standing provisions for instances like this, i.e. when sensitive material or equipment is likely to fall into what is considered the wrong hands. And yes, I would have imagined the crew would have done all they could to attempt to minimize what could be learnt from what was on board their aeroplane.
How valuable, then, is the information that presumably wasn't destroyed?
I think that the Chinese, if they are able to understand what they're looking at, will get the most from any software that is still intact within the aircraft, because if you think about it, the laws of physics are the laws of physics. So a radio receiver might be an advanced design, but it is still a radio receiver, and this will be nothing new to the Chinese. What America definitely has the edge on in systems like this is the ability to create software to integrate different pieces of equipment together into a unified whole, to using software to analyze in great detail signals that are intercepted by systems like this, and perhaps most importantly, to fuse that data together with data from other platforms, other sources, and to be able to transmit that in very close to real time to other users, to commanders, to the national authority. And that, I think, is if the Chinese can get to that, they will have got a real catch.
Martin Streetley, editor of Jane's Electronic Mission Aircraft. What exactly, well, I should say, what do you think happened in the sky?
It's very hard to tell. These flights go on all the time. And usually, and they are, and let us be quite clear about this, 99.99% of the time conducted in international airspace where it is quite legitimate so to do. When a nation like China detects one of these aeroplanes trundling along its coastline, it will send up fighter aeroplanes to say, hey guys, we know you're there. And this goes on regularly. It becomes a little problematic if, because of the disparity of performance between a high-performance jet fighter and a relatively slow propeller-driven aeroplane like the Orion. And I think that it more than any...
And the Orion is what the Chinese pilot was flying?
No, the Orion is, what I meant to say was the EP-3E Ares 2. It is based on an aeroplane called the Orion. I think that this is, I would be very surprised if there was any deliberate action by either side. I think it is a terribly unfortunate accident.
I wanted to bring a former U.S. Air Force captain in on the conversation, who we began speaking with last week. He's Dale Brown, flew a B-52 on U.S. spy missions over the former Soviet Union, over Russian ships. Welcome to Democracy Now! Again.
Hi, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. What we didn't get to talk about last week was the whole issue of these cat and mouse games and how frequent they are. For example, when you were flying, were you ever tailed by a Russian fighter plane?
No, not necessarily by Russian fighter planes. Our mission flying the B-52, because we had such long range and because we had the K-12 camera system where we could take very highly detailed photos from directly beneath the airplane. Our mission was to fly over Soviet ships and photograph them, try to get them to shine radars on us, basically to see what sort of radars and what sort of weapon systems they had on board, and then we could analyze that, and we could copy down the frequencies, and we could give all that information to the various intelligence people who wanted them. So our job was to do anything that we could to try to goad the Russian Navy into doing something with us. And they didn't have the capability of bringing fighters up against us. They did launch helicopters to try to keep us away from the ships. We played a cat and mouse game also. We weren't really. According to international law, we weren't allowed to fly directly over the ships, but we did. Uh, we weren't really supposed to go below 1,000 feet above the ships. We did. We were trying to get some sort of response from the Soviet Navy.
And how frequent are these kind of interactions in international air?
They're quite frequent, depending on exactly what each side is doing. In this case, it was the Soviet Navy's summer cruise around the Pacific, and they would bring, I believe it was about 32 ships along, and they would just cruise up and down the coast, just really to prove they could do it. And I think in this case with the Chinese fighters going up to chase out the EP-3 from their operating area, they had an exercise going on. I've heard various tales about what's going on. The latest that I've heard was that the Chinese were going to test a submarine launch cruise missile. So when we hear of these things happening, then we start launching reconnaissance and intelligence gathering aircraft to try to learn more about the test. So the more tests there are, the more operations we have. But it also goes on a routine basis. There are probes. There are a very small operations to try to test the other side to find out how far they're willing to go. To find out what they're trying to look at, to find out the capabilities of their radars or their other weapon systems. This really does go on all the time, but mostly I would say it goes on when there's actually something going on, a very important test, some sort of redeployment of forces, things like that.
Martin Streetley of Jane's, what about the precedents for this? North Korea shooting down a spy plane?
Oh, I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, I think signals intelligence flights of the sort we're talking about probably started during the Second World War. And certainly during the late 1950s and early 1960s, signals intelligence was a rough game. And there are a number of instances. There was an aeroplane was shot down off North Korea with the loss of 31 people on board in 1967. An RB-47 was shot down over the Bering Sea. In the early 60s, there were a lot of instances of aeroplanes being shot at. Thankfully, I think today, it is more a matter of interceptors coming up and looking at aeroplanes and saying, we know you're here, or trying to, as the gentleman has just said, to mask, to drive off aircraft looking, say, at a battle group. Thankfully, people are not shooting at each other.
In the case of North Korea, though, they shot down a comparable plane, right, and killed a number of U.S. servicemen.
Yes. Oh, yes.
How many?
31 were on board that airplane.
Uh-huh. And what year was that?
That was 1967.
Right now, as you view this, and I'm also wondering in the British press, how this is being played as... in terms of the U.S. giving or not giving the apology, picking up the level of response from we regret to, I believe Colin Powell issued the word sorry about the killing of the Chinese pilot.
Well, I think first and foremost, one should say that obviously I don't think anybody would wish to be responsible or otherwise or involved in the death of a military pilot in this way. I think what one is seeing is, to a certain degree, the sort of rhetoric that one would expect in a circumstance like this. The Chinese would wish to have a look at the aeroplane, would perhaps wish to stall the moment when they return the aeroplane and the crew, which, incidentally, I believe that they will do in both instances. I think the crew will return home safely, and I think the aeroplane will come back. It may come back in pieces, but it will come back.
Exactly.
But I think we are hearing rhetoric, and I don't think, if one thinks about it, both nations are proud countries. I think it is very difficult for anybody to step back. I'm not at all qualified to discuss, I mean, what I'm saying to you now is a personal view. I'm not at all qualified to discuss the politics of this, but that would be my reading of it, that it is rhetoric more than, a real... degeneration into a very serious crisis. At the present time.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, I want to ask Dale Brown about if a full apology were issued by the United States, would that make the U.S. airmen spies, and could they then be tried in a Chinese court? We're talking to Dale Brown, former Air Force captain who flew a B-52 over Russian ships. Martin Streetly, editor of Jane's Electronic Mission Aircraft, speaking to us from London. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by a professor of philosophy who taught at Fudan University in Shanghai for 4 years about the history of U.S.-China relations. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
Listen closely what I say to you. In the shipyard, in the factory, it might look just like you, but it might look just like me, but then...
Randy Newman singing Spies here on Democracy Now! What about that issue of spies, Dale Brown, former U.S. Air Force captain? I was on C-SPAN yesterday, and one of the viewers called in to say, wait a second, if the United States issues a full apology, that'll admit that the U.S. service people are spies and they could be tried for that.
Well, absolutely not. That I mean, that's more of a legal matter, but legally speaking, I don't think that that doesn't follow at all. But it is more of a political question. What if the president does apologize, which I absolutely do not think he should do? It would send the wrong message to his own military forces. It would tell them that perhaps they did something wrong, that they were doing something they shouldn't have done, that perhaps the Chinese allegations that this great big lumbering aircraft somehow turned in front of a fighter and downed it without downing itself was true, and that the Chinese can make up any scenario and make up a story, and that the world should believe it, and that all the time for the past week the United States has been lying about this. And I think it would look extraordinarily bad for the United States, and I think it would send the wrong message to all those naval and Air Force troops that are out there right now still conducting intelligence operations over that area.
Well, let's turn to Henry Rosemont, who's a professor of philosophy at St. Mary's College of Maryland, taught at Fudan University in Shanghai for 4 years. What about this issue of an apology?
Well, I think it is the case that had the plane not been there, and even our own press refers to it as a spy plane, the Chinese pilot would not have died. And that suggests the United States ought to apologize.
I know you have a sore throat. If you
could
put the phone
that.
As close to your mouth as possible.
I'm sorry, you can't hear me?
Yes, I can. We can hear you now. Well, what do you think the U.S. should be saying?
The U.S. should apologize for what it has done in being over those waters. They were international waters. Both sides have said that. The United States, I think, acted very hastily at the outset, first in publicizing the incident, perhaps of quiet diplomacy behind the scenes. The incident could have been resolved without any difficulties whatsoever. It's also the case that our diplomatic relations call for diplomatic access to detain citizens of the other country within 48 hours President Bush began demanding that access long before the 48 hours were up. To the best of my knowledge, the Chinese complied within 48 hours. There was earlier referenced by a couple of you to a cat and mouse game. And the Chinese perception, quite correctly, is the Chinese are always the mice. And they're angry about that. The plane was spying. It was trying to get at their security. The same thing happened with the roles reverse over Santa Catalina Island. And the Chinese spy plane had been forced to land at San Diego Naval Air Station. The American people would have been absolutely outraged by that. They would have been mourning the loss of the U.S. pilot.
What about the couple weeks ago, probably more than a month ago now, the U.S. nuclear submarine that ended up killing 9 people on the Japanese fishing training vessel, including 4 high school students, and the way the U.S. responded there? Do you see connections, the whole issue of how they issued an apology and how long it took them?
Yes, I don't think we handled that as well as we might have either. There is a the importance of faith and accepting responsibility for what one has done that East Asian people of all kinds take very, very seriously. We seem to have been at best wooden in our response to the Japanese, and downright belligerent with respect to the present case with the Chinese.
Professor Henry Rosemont, can you talk a little about the history of U.S.-China relations and how what we're seeing today falls into that context for the Chinese?
Well, even in the Western history books now, we refer to the period of the 1840s, 50s, and 60s as gunboat diplomacy with the Chinese, and we refer to the treaties that we obliged the Chinese to sign as unequal treaties, which they quite clearly were. When the United States insisted upon the sovereignty of that plane, telling Chinese to keep out of it, even though it was on Chinese soil, while legally that is correct, it reminds the Chinese of the extraterritoriality that they were obliged to undergo for 100 years, beginning in 1843. That doctrine being that because Chinese laws were sufficiently barbaric, American citizens on Chinese soil had to be tried under their own legal system and not that of the Chinese. Chinese with long memories still feel very hostile about that, and they see some of this as a resurgence of it today.
I mean, we're talking about two countries today that are not enemies, China and the United States. In fact, I'm sure that President Bush is very aware of all the U.S. corporations from Walmart to Nike, Reebok, the sneaker companies that have moved to China because of a very repressed, cheap labor force. Lots of corporations, nuclear power corporations, as well as others, they see China as a vast market, and they don't want strained relations, as China will, the Chinese military and the government will reap huge benefits from this in terms of financial investment.
The Chinese military don't see it that way. Some of the Chinese entrepreneurial elites now, party and non-party members alike, may see it that way, but I don't believe the military does. The military quite rightly feels itself distinctly inferior to the U.S. military, and feels, again correctly, that it has almost no ability to retaliate to things that are done. They can't send that kind of spy plane over here. It was a wild scenario, I suggested, coming to Santa Catalina Island. We have sanctions against allowing any other government to sell the kind of sophisticated equipment that was on board that EP-3 to the Chinese. We have almost 100,000 troops stationed in various parts of Asia. The Chinese have none in the Northern Hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere. That kind of thing would rightly make the equivalent of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in China very, very nervous. Very nervous.
I'm looking at a piece in today's Wall Street Journal, China's military shows growing political China's military shows growing political sway. And in the midst of the piece, it says the stern military reaction has been set in part by a general known for anti-American outbursts. Lieutenant General Xiang Guangkai, a deputy head of the People's Liberation Army's general staff who handles intelligence matters, is the most senior officer on an interagency task force dealing with the downed plane, diplomats say. General Xiang has in the past argued for uncompromising stances toward Taiwan and against U.S. support for the island, hence the government's harder line on U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. Given to theatrical tirades and flashes of charm, he last year sang Edelweiss to U.S. Admiral Dennis Blair during a dinner for the commander of U.S. forces in the Pacific, who is on a mission to China to calm tensions during Taiwan's presidential elections. 4 years earlier, in the tense run-up to Taiwan's previous presidential poll in 1996, General Xiang notoriously threatened to drop a nuclear bomb on Los Angeles.
He doesn't have the ability to do that. And clearly the best way to ease the tensions would be those to have more military exchanges between the two countries to reduce that kind of hostility. We have the same kind of Cold Warrior rhetoric in this country that the Chinese do, and there are far more Chinese, I believe, that would like to moderate this and not see it escalate into anything else. But that won't be done by saber-rattling on both sides, especially when we have most of the sabers. The Chinese, if cornered, are going to get increasingly hostile, and the military will be built up by the hardliners rather than by those who would wish for a more peaceful coexistence.
Captain Dale Brown, your response.
Well, I've got so many responses here that I don't know where to start. The idea that the United States needs to apologize for flying intelligence missions near the Chinese coast is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. All the saber rattling that has been going on over the past week has been going on the Chinese side. The United States is not threatening any military action against us. There's been all sorts of talk by various pundits about perhaps doing some sort of a rescue mission. That's the U.S. government hasn't even hinted at that. The Chinese have clearly been the ones that are playing to the politics and playing to the people as much as they can about trying to challenge the United States. The things they've been doing about threatening nuclear retaliation, threatening nuclear war, that's a very serious thing to do. You just don't toss out terms like that. Whether or not they have the actual capability to do it is irrelevant. The fact that any nation in the world today would actually threaten nuclear war against another country is completely astounding. But getting back to the apology idea, spy missions, intelligence gathering information over international waters occurs all the time. It's a legal policy, and it's a moral policy. All the other crews were listening. They were unarmed aircraft flying over open water, listening, and that's all they were doing. Now, whether or not it was a good idea to land on Chinese soil, whether or not that gives the Chinese any special rights, that's another question that we can debate. But the idea that we did that, and that by doing that we owe the Chinese an apology, and then going back even further into history, saying that we've wronged the Chinese for decades and decades, so it's about time that we give them an apology, is a completely ridiculous idea.
Professor Rosemont.
I don't think it's irrelevant that the Chinese couldn't deliver on the threat of an atomic bomb if they wished. When we approached the Russians about the nuclear defense missile shield, we told them not to worry because they have over 5,500 missiles, which could easily penetrate any shield we put up. The Chinese have only 60, and they're on low alert. 40 of them are in silos and land, and 20 are on submarines, which almost never stray very far from port. This may sound astounding to Professor Brown, but these things don't sound astounding at all if you're Chinese, and that's the perspective I'm trying to give you. What the spy plane was doing, whether legal or not, it was trying to breach Chinese security. And if the Chinese tried to do the same thing to us, and we lost an American Air Force pilot, we'd be very, very angry.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us, as well as Martin Streetley from Jane's. That's Janes Electronic Mission Aircraft at www.janes.com. Professor Henry Rosemont speaking to us from Maryland, St. Mary's College, who taught at Fudan University in Shanghai for 4 years. And finally, Dale Brown. He will have a forthcoming book called Warrior Class. He is a former U.S. Air Force captain who flew spy missions, a B-52, over Russian ships. Thank you both for being with us. As we move now to another international issue before coming home to talk about the issue of arsenic in the country's waters. But looking now at South America, Alejandro Toledo looks like he could well win the presidency of Peru, but he does appear to have fallen short of the majority required to avert a runoff. We are going now down to Peru to speak with Javier Diaz-Canseco, former member of the Peruvian Congress and opposition leader. Welcome to Democracy Now! We'll go to him in just 1 second, but as we wait to go to him, we will go to our music break and then come back with Javier Diaz-Canseco. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we go down to Lima, Peru to speak with Javier Diaz-Canseco, longtime left member of Congress. He just ran again yesterday for a seat in Congress. And we're going to talk about Alejandro Toledo and his, well, looks like he is on the way to winning the presidency of Peru. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the significance of yesterday's election?
Well, I see the first time that we've had for a long time, for the first time in more than 10 years, a really democratic electoral process, transparent, and with no significant problem in the election. Even though it's been a short time for campaign, no more than 90 days, it's been a very interesting process, and the results are quite important. The Electoral Authority has recently, 10 minutes ago, gave its eighth report. After the control of 50% of the vote of the country, Toledo has 36% of the national vote. Juan Garcia, 6% of the vote.
What percent of the vote for the
Lourdes Flores? Sorry.
What percent of the vote for the former Peruvian president Alan Garcia?
26%.
26.
Yes, Lourdes Flores, which represents what I would call the center-right or right alternative, represents around 23% of the vote. And then it's Fernando Olivera of the Independent Moralization Front that has around 10% of the vote. And the former ex-minister of finance, Fujimori, who also ran, has 0.7% of the vote.
0.7.
The absence is around 16 or 17% of the Peruvians. In Peru, the vote is obligatory. And the people who voted blank or who voted no are around 11% of the electoral population. That is, I'd say around 30% of the population didn't go to vote or voted no or in blank, no? We will have a second round, probably in around 30 days, between Toledo and Garcia. Obviously, the result represents an absolute failure of the neoliberal policies, which were quite identified with Bologna and with Lourdes Flores. They will have no opportunity to run in the second round. And there is a great social and economic demand of changes, which obviously will permit Peru to debate a change in the economic policy in trying to respond to social demands that have been for a very long time postponed.
Javier Diaz-Canseco, it is a little hard to understand you as you're in a cell phone in Lima, Peru, but I wanted to ask about the call for Fujimori, the leader who's forced out in Japan now, to be tried for murder charges against the MRTA rebels who were executed after the Peruvian military took over the Japanese embassy that the MRTA were holding with the hostages. You yourself were a hostage for a little while, is that right?
Yes, that is true. We are working quite hard on two ideas. One is that the government should have a special commission to work on a strategy to bring Fujimori and Montesinos back to Peru so that they are tried. We are asking the provisional government to name the Minister of Foreign Relations, the Minister of Justice, and the Minister of Interior so that they can respond for a national and international strategy to bring back Fujimori and Montesinos. On the other hand, we are also working on a national civic committee to bring back Montesinos and Fujimori, working with people of the church, with people of the social movement, of the trade unions, of different political parties, so that we can make a campaign in Japan to do everything we can to bring them back and try them, not only because of those crimes, but because of their relation with drug trafficking, because they stole a great amount of money of the Peruvian budget, and because of the corruption and crimes that they are responsible of.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. Also, at the same time, you have Lori Berenson, who is on trial right through this election. Is that right?
Yes, she is actually in trial. It is now a civil court that is trying her, and I'm absolutely sure that the sentence for Lori Berenson will be quite different.
Will be what?
The one she received from the military court.
You're saying will be quite different?
Yes, I think so.
What do you think?
It was absolutely absurd to accuse a North American of treason to Peru because she's not a Peruvian national. And the responsibility she had is not of a person who is ahead of a terrorist or subversive movement. No, she had a link with the MRTA movement, but it was a collaboration. It was not a central responsibility. She, I am absolutely sure, will not be condemned to a life sentence or 25 years.
Her father said something like 20 years he is seeing in the way the questioning is going. Do you think that that is the case?
That is what they are asking for, but I don't know what will happen. We will have to observe. It's difficult to say.
Well, we hope to get her parents on soon, who are in Lima observing the trial of Lori Berenson. Javier Diaz-Canseco also ran for Congress. You'll find out soon the results of his own election. But again, it sounds like there will be a runoff between the former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, and Alejandro Toledo, who is well ahead but didn't quite capture the majority vote. I want to thank you for being with us and speaking to us from Lima, Peru. As we move now to a national issue here in the United States. In the last days of his term, President Clinton announced that finally, complying with a 40-year-old recommendation, the U.S. would lower the amount of arsenic allowable in drinking water. The standard would have dropped the allowable level from 50 parts per billion to 10 parts per billion and brought it in line with World Health Organization standards. In the first days of his presidency, George Bush overturned that decision, bringing great pleasure to the mining interests, which are one of the largest sources of arsenic pollution. But in addition to being a toxic byproduct of coal and gold extraction, arsenic occurs naturally in much of America's drinking water. In Michigan, for example, much of the state is exposed to levels that may increase not only cancer rates, but exacerbate heart illness and diabetes. To talk about the causes and effects of Bush's decision, we're joined by a scientist and a physician who have been documenting the problem. Michael Harbutt joins us from Detroit. He is a physician and professor at Wayne State University. We're also joined by Paul Mushak, who is a toxicologist and environmental health risk specialist in Durham, North Carolina. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Dr. Mushak. The government claims there's no sound science to prove that arsenic is carcinogenic. Is that true?
Oh, that's simply not true. We have an overwhelming body of evidence saying otherwise. And in fact, the most recent data for cancer incidence is especially alarming. The data is in, and really what we lack is the political will, if you will, to do something about it.
How far back do the recommendations go?
Well, the recommendations for a value of 10 micrograms per liter, which is equivalent to 10 parts per billion, actually dates to the early 60s. In 1962, the U.S. Public Health Service recommended that be the new standard and not 50. So we're looking at 10 as a value that's been sort of knocking around in regulatory circles for about 40 years.
Well, why did it take so long, 40 years, to the last days of the Clinton administration?
Well, I think it's been the history of arsenic regulation in the U.S. is sort of a tale of, you know, obfuscation, delay, regulatory uncertainty in terms of, you know, is the cost worth it, especially in the Western U.S., but also in other parts, such as Dr. Harbutt's area in Michigan and also in New England. It's been an amalgam of political pressures, the evolution of research and the rate of that evolution, and also the cost of compliance. It's always been understood that if you have to treat for arsenic, it's going to be expensive.
Michael Harbutt, you're a physician, and you worked with arsenic victims in Detroit. What are the symptoms of someone who has arsenic poisoning?
Well, I think one of the important things to understand about arsenic poisoning is that it is an independent risk factor or a co-causer, if you will, in actually the most common causes of disease and death in the United States. It's been associated with the occurrence of diabetes, of heart disease, of kidney failure, of circulatory disease, of neurologic disorders, of abdominal pain, profound fatigue. All of these sorts of things which occur in the population, separate from cancer, which is the basis largely of the federal regulation as it was proposed before it was undone. Arsenic is associated with the occurrence of all of these maladies. And in fact, last year, one of my colleagues here in Detroit and I published a paper saying that arsenic's presence in the urine ought to be considered an independent risk factor equivalent to high cholesterol, smoking, sort of commonly known risk factors for heart disease, cerebrovascular disease, diabetes, as well as cancers. So a typical patient who is exposed in the water table to high levels of arsenic does not have a specifically uniquely identifiable arsenic disease. It's a disease which is known to be caused by arsenic, but arsenic is generally one of the independent risk factors and has been isolated as a cause in and of itself of these terrible diseases.
Now, just to clarify, arsenic has long been known to be a cause of cancer, but has not been associated with heart disease and diabetes?
This is fairly recent data, recent in the scientific sense within the last 10 years or so. You know, I think it's important, if I may, add the following thought to this whole regulatory issue. This was not a decision that to lower the arsenic standard that President Clinton made on his way out of the White House between pilfering the silverware and pardoning Mark Rich. I mean, this was not some off-the-cuff, let's get Bush decision. This was a decision which was long overdue, and in fact, the Natural Resources Defense Council had to file a lawsuit to get the EPA to act on this last year. This is a product of years and years of research and analysis and scientific consensus building. So this is not new information like last Tuesday. This is information which is in the last several years.
Paul Mushak in Durham, North Carolina, what are the interests that have opposed these arsenic regulations that have now been repealed by President Bush?
Well, the most visible interests are, of course, the water utilities, and especially since a number of the utilities in the West, those areas where, you know, conforming with regulatory requirements to reduce arsenic in drinking water would be expensive and, you know, presumably would affect the bottom line. But also there are, if you will, really heavy caliber affected industries in the background. You had indicated the mining interests, but there are also the electric utilities, a major source of arsenic in the waste stream of fossil fuel power plants is arsenic, both in terms of stack emissions as well as fly ash. So while we are sort of focused on utilities, actually these other folks are quite concerned. And the basis of the concern is simply that because of the issue of regulatory harmonizing, if you will, across different programmatic and legal functions of EPA, if you regulate arsenic in drinking water at a level of X, and X is lower than Y, then the potential impact on all other industries who, say, contaminate drinking water will be correspondingly made more expensive, or the cleanup be more extensive. So there are many players in this in terms of affected regulated stakeholders, if you will. The utilities have been the most vocal, but they're almost like a sort of a stalking horse for other heavy caliber industries, and even more heavy caliber, perhaps.
Uh-huh. Like? Even more heavy caliber?
Oh, yes. Well, I think the power utilities, uh-huh, for example, would be a good example. Uh-huh. And the mining interests. I think that if you look in the aggregate at the, say, the Superfund activities of the various regions of EPA, including the western region, you'll find that arsenic, like lead, you know, keeps recurring as a contaminant of concern.
Michael Harbutt, does the water filters that people put on their faucets take out arsenic?
Generally not. To take arsenic out of the water requires some pretty sophisticated technology. The filters that you send with your kids to college generally don't do the trick, or the kind of you just put on the faucet. It requires a reverse osmosis filter or some mechanism which produces what is essentially distilled water. So common filters, I think for people who are concerned about removing arsenic and other contaminants from the water, to read the side of water filter labels is often quite revealing.
And if you have arsenic poisoning or contamination, what can you do about it?
Well, I think it's important. I think it's important to remember that to find out if you are sick from arsenic, or you're told you have arsenic in your water, or you have the signs or symptoms or common diseases which are associated with arsenosis, which is the phrase we're using now for illness caused by arsenic, a 24-hour urine test is the most important thing to do with your personal physician. You know, the argument about the levels in the water table only holds so much water, forgive me, please. The fact of the matter is if you measure the water table today, and it's 54 parts per billion, if you do it next Wednesday at 3 in the afternoon, it may be 80 parts per billion. We're dealing with, in terms of water table arsenic concentrations, something which is subject to the weather, so it varies significantly. I think the most important thing is the 24-hour urine arsenic.
And at this point, with Bush turning back these regs, is there any chance that they will be restored?
Well, you know, this is an interesting question. It's also important to note in this question, parenthetically, that the old regulation required people consuming water at 5 parts per billion to be warned it could be dangerous. And then this weekend, Christy Todd Whitman was quoted in the New York Times as saying, just wait, we might even make them lower, or words to that effect. You know, assuming there are people in this administration who are able to glean statistics more sophisticated than those found on baseball cards, The numbers will become quite clear, I think, and they'll either be forced to at least warn people about the risks of arsenic, or their responsibility to the public health will have been neglected.
How many people will get cancer as a result of arsenic poisoning?
Well, nobody knows for sure. One of the arguments, I think Dr. Mushak could certainly give a better answer than I.
Get a one-syllable answer, because I have 30 seconds?
Dr. Mushak is better.
Dr. Mushak?
Yeah, well,
Real fast.
Yeah, it depends. Up to 1 in 100 at the rollback level.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you for being with us. People can check the website for contact information at webactive.com. Paul Mushak, toxicologist. Michael Harbutt, physician. Thanks for joining us. That does it for the show. Terry Allen, Chris Abrams, thanks. Anthony Sloaner, engineer, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of You, our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.